Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the December 2009/January edition of the Ladies' Home Journal. It is a combination issue. The first article is called Simplify Your Holidays. This year's Follow the Less is More approach. And here are four tips. Undeck the halls. Forget climbing up on the roof to hang lights. Instead, spread easy and foolproof net lights over the bushes out front. Or hang a lighted wreath on the door and add your own bow. Hint number two. Don't shop till you drop. Buy in bulk for the non-family folks on your list. Wrap tins of nuts. Write greetings on wine bottles with a metallic paint pen, or slip a Starbucks gift card into many stocking ornaments. Hint number three, get the party started. A dessert and champagne party is much easier than a dinner party, and guests love it. Bake goodies ahead of time and freeze in airtight tins. Our fourth hint, give back. Go through your Christmas closet early. Pull out all the decorations you no longer need and donate them so someone else can have a festive holiday. The next article is a series of short stories about different people's family. It's about feeling great and gift giving. It isn't the size of the gift that matters, but the size of the heart that gives it. The first story is from Mia Molina Schaefer, stationed in an Air Force base in Iraq. More than a ring. When I was 19 in 2001, I was both excited and anxious about starting at the U.S. Naval Academy. Parents often attend induction day, but my mom couldn't afford the plane ticket. Before I left, she hugged me and handed me an envelope. Then I boarded the plane alone. After takeoff, I opened Mom's letter and read how proud she was of me. Mayada, her pet name for me, you were bound for greatness, she wrote. My mother had sacrificed so much throughout my childhood, and thanks to her love, I felt prepared to take on any challenge. To my surprise, there was an antique ring in the envelope. The ring had been passed down to my mom by her own stepmother when she began her journey as a woman. It was platinum with a square face and a diamond in the middle. As a young adult, I knew this gift represented my mom's recognition that I was growing up. I've carried my mom's unconditional love and strength in my heart and on my finger through 4 years at the academy and two combat tours in Iraq as a Marine officer. The ring reminds me of the sacrifices my mom made for her children. I think of that as I serve to keep this country safe and look forward to the day when I can pass this heirloom along to a daughter of my own. Our second story is from Nicole Young from Decatur, Georgia. It's called Precious Ornaments. When my daughter Lauren was 14 months old, she got cranky and didn't want to eat. The doctors diagnosed an ear infection and gave us antibiotics. 2 days later, Laura died in her sleep. My husband David and I were devastated. It turned out that Lauren had a rare metabolic disorder that prevents the liver from breaking down fat. We had no idea. She always seemed healthy. The first Christmas without her was hard, but our family and church provided us with strength. The next Christmas, in 2006, my mother-in-law gave me an etched glass ornament with Lauren's name, dates of birth, and date of death on it. It's beautiful, but the best thing is that it's tangible. I can proudly display it because I want people to ask about my daughter. I want to talk about her. That's what keeps her memory alive. Since then, Lauren ornaments have become a tradition. We now have six. They're always up on our mantle, not just at Christmas, for anyone and everyone who comes to our house to see. Our next story is from Lauren Miller from Colorado. It's called Back in the Saddle. Riding horses has always been a big part of my life. Ironically, the man I married was allergic to them. After riding, I'd have to take off my clothes in the basement, then dash upstairs to shower. My daughter, Kaylin, was also allergic to horses as a small child, but like me, she loved them. Luckily, her allergies cleared up enough that she could ride comfortably. It was something we really enjoyed together. In 2005, after 17 years of marriage, my husband and I decided to get a divorce. Shortly before our final court date, I learned that I had stage 3 breast cancer. I was 38 years old, divorced, and fighting for my life. Over the next 2 years, I had a double mastectomy, 11 other surgeries for infections, 16 rounds of chemotherapy, and 6 weeks of daily radiation. When you're getting chemo, your white blood count is low, and you don't heal normally. But I insisted on riding with my daughter. On one of our rides, I got thrown from my horse, and I hung on so hard I ripped all the skin off my hands. In agony, I looked at Kaylin and said, "I can't do this," and I wasn't just talking about riding. Then for Christmas 2006, Kaylin, who was 12, did something that said, "You are going to do this, Mom." She called my parents and siblings to ask them to chip in for a special gift. When I came downstairs Christmas morning, there was a beautiful Western saddle sitting under the tree. I was blown away. Now that I'm in complete remission, my life and passions have been restored in many ways. And about a year ago, I was finally able to take that beautiful saddle and put it on our family horse and ride again. Our next Christmas story is from Jen Reeder, also of Colorado. Stitched with love. Even as a child, I liked adventure. So after graduating from college in 1994, I wanted to see the world. Brian, the man who would become my husband, also had the travel bug, and we took off together. Over the years, we went to Guatemala, Colombia, Thailand, and the Philippines. We saw amazing things: a red lake with flamingos in Bolivia, the ancient temples in Cambodia. Mom and Dad were supportive, but also worried, and always showed their concern with a reminder to be safe when I called every few weeks to check in with them. My mom had taken up quilting when I took up traveling, so when I was home for Christmas in 1999, she surprised me with a breathtaking quilt she made. The pattern, aptly, is called Around the World. There was a lot of crying and hugging and kissing when Mom shyly said, "It took thousands of hours to make." I knew that this was truly a labor of love. While I'd been abroad, she was stitching all her motherly love and concern into the fabric of my quilt. Our next short story is from Aaron from Georgia. It's called Field of Dreams. I grew up in Massachusetts and lived for the Boston Red Sox. I even had a team tattoo. My husband Adam loves that he can ask how'd the Sox do, and I can always give him a recap. Sometimes he asks from very far away. He's in the Army, and in our 13-year marriage, he's been deployed 7 times. I should be used to it by now, but the holidays are still hard for me. In 2007, Adam was in Iraq. He called Christmas morning to hear our son, Addison, opening his presents. I put on a brave face for Addison, but it still tore me apart that Adam wasn't with us. A few days later, a manila envelope arrived with my name on it. I opened it and pulled out a tiny baggie and thought, "What the heck is this?" Then I read the letter that came with it. Adam had arranged to have dirt from the Sox infield sent to me. Amazing. I owned a piece of Fenway. That simple act from thousands of miles away made me realize how much Adam really understands me. He knows that dirt from Fenway Park means more to me than any fancy clothes or jewelry. I cherish the dirt, but this Christmas I'm getting an even better gift. Adam will be home, and that's really all I want. Our next story is from Dana from Texas. It's called Ski Report. I learned to water ski at the age of 32. Charlie, my boyfriend, was a great skier and took on the task of teaching me. I wasn't very athletic, but I would have done anything to be near this guy. I was scared, and I took some spectacular falls, but Charlie was patient. By 1991, Charlie and I were engaged and had just bought a house, so we knew it would be a lean Christmas. But after opening the stocking stuffers we bought each other, Charlie said, "There's one more thing." He reached around the sofa and brought out this custom-made water ski. It was very sleek and very purple. "Now I know he's in it for keeps," I thought. "He bought me a ski, and that meant more than the house or the ring. It made me more confident, and soon I started to love water skiing. It's the closest you can come to flying. The wind, the spray, the freedom. There's nothing like it." In September 2008, Hurricane Ike devastated our area. We lost a lot, but when I realized my ski was gone, I sobbed like a baby. I knew it was stupid to cry over a ski, but it just meant that much to me. Next is the Answer Lady column, where she handles manners and morals in a question and answer basis. The first question. I work for a large company, and every holiday season, coworkers hit me up to buy stuff for their kids' school fundraisers. I already buy from my own children, plus I'm on a tight budget. Is there a nice way to say no? Here's her answer. Saying, "Sorry, I've already blown the budget for school fundraisers this year," sounds nice enough to me. It rolls off the tongue even more easily. In fact, if you do set a limit and keep track of how you dole it out, when the money's gone, you're off the hook. Or copy my friend who simply makes a donation to her PTA each term, period. I did it last year, even though it meant my poor little daughter wasn't in the race to get the iPod or the bike or the Lamborghini that's awarded to that top candy seller. Fortunately, after you say no to your coworkers a few times, they'll eventually stop asking. Second question. I recently discovered my teenage cousin has a Facebook profile, and apparently he hasn't heard of privacy settings. I've been horrified by some of the things he posts. Drinking and hooking up are major themes. Should I tell his parents or mind my own business? Here's her answer. If you and your cousin are close, the first thing you might want to do is share your concerns with him, preferably by sending him a private message rather than posting a public comment. Perhaps something like this. If I'm reading this, who else? Teachers? College admissions people? Your grandparents? Your girlfriend's parents? Hope you're being careful, and I don't just mean in cyberspace. Since his drinking could have serious consequences, there's nothing like an underage DUI to screw up your life or end it altogether, you should also have a conversation with his parents to see if they have any clue on what Junior is up to, or just suggest they sign up for a Facebook account and let them learn about his extracurricular activities for themselves. The last question. A close friend of mine has gained some weight and complains to me about it constantly. It's driving me nuts, especially since she makes no attempt to do anything to drop the extra pounds. Do I dare give her any advice? Answer. You can, but bear in mind that delivery matters a lot. We are talking about one of the most sensitive topics among all of womankind here. Subtly and critique-free phrasings are a must. Rather than tell her that she should cut back on cheeseburgers, for example, you could casually mention that you made the most amazing low-fat dinner last night and offer to share the recipe. Or if she unwittingly orders the richest, unhealthiest caffeine concoction when you two are out for coffee, fill her in slyly. "Oh, I love that drink too, but I nearly passed out when I found out how many calories are in it. Lucky for me, the light version tastes really good. You might also invite her to exercise with you and make a pact that the only time you two can talk about weight is when you're burning it off together. Here's another article on the Christmas holidays. It's called Sugar on Top. I'm hardly an expert baker, but decorating cookies have brought joy to my world. By Lee Stokes Hilton. I'm going to the city today, I say. What for, my husband asks. Sprinkles. I admit it, I'm obsessed with sprinkles. I began to suspect as much when I went shopping for storage containers to hold my jars of Jimmy's, Nonpareil's, sanding sugars, edible glitter, and three sizes of silver and gold dragées. I could barely fit them into all of those plastic drawers from Bed Bath & Beyond. This is not a cupcake obsession. I know cupcakes are hot items these days, but I mean cookies. Roll out cookies and shapes to suit any occasion. My neighbor says she's having a Western theme party, and I have visions of cactus bristling with emerald jimmies, cowboy hats and white or blue sanding sugar, boots, jalapenos, and silver stars shining. Before the thought has gelled, I hear myself say, "Want me to make cookies?" Then my husband forwards me an email message from two guys in his office announcing plans for a department picnic. And I fire back, tell them I make cookies. I'm thinking fish and suns and t-shirts. Maybe I could find a sunglass shape. It all started a dozen or so years ago while I was pulling the menu for a post-Christmas dinner party together and racked my brain for an easy do-ahead dessert. Okay, maybe not easy, but certainly do-ahead. My mother-in-law, who was visiting, suggested roll-out cookies. Oh, I can't do those, I told her. She didn't know how the rolling-out business made me crazy. I could never keep the dough from sticking to the rolling pin, and I hated it getting under my fingernails, and I don't like touching goopy things. Though I love to cook, I put on rubber gloves when making meatloaf or rinsing chicken. Put the dough between two sheets of floured wax paper, she said. It's the easy way. It was an epiphany. I'll admit that even with the wax paper, it took me several rounds of practice before I got the technique down. But once over the initial hurdle, I rolled wild and free. Over time, I've come to know this dough, the proportion of butter to Crisco that maintains flavor yet keeps the shapes intact. In the oven, the warm smell of vanilla tweaked with a bit of lemon, the firmness of properly chilled dough. I can tell at a glance if I need to be more liberal in dusting the wax paper. And one time the mushy texture was the clue that told me that our refrigerator was dying. Now I haunt kitchen stores for interesting cookie-cutter shapes, the way my husband might look for a vintage port, or the way our dog sniffs out an errant scrap of food on the kitchen floor. It's the decorating that really gets me into trouble. I'm not terribly artistic, but like a magpie, I love shiny things. So I spread just enough powdered sugar icing to cover a cookie before adding red crystal sugar to the jalapenos with the finer green sanding sugar on the stems. I top off the cacti with dabs of yellow icing and large gold dragées for flowers. I sprinkle the boots with black or brown edible glitter and pipe on designs with those little tubes of colored icing from the grocery store. In any season, for any occasion, I find myself contemplating cookie shapes and decorations thereof. Halloween brings black bats and cats and witches' hats, white ghosts and ribbed orange pumpkins. I have cookies shapes for back to school, Oscar night, New Year's Eve, and other major holidays. And at Christmas, I barely have time to shop for presents between the annual inventory of sprinkles and my trip to West 22nd Street and the hallowed halls of the New York Cake and Baking, where tables piled high with nonpareils, sanding sugars, and dragées await. Ah, the dragées. In the world of sprinkles, dragées, are the non plus. These little silver and gold bars look like BBs or rifle shot and come in containers labeled not suitable for eating. Because of the minute amounts of metal in dragees, the Food and Drug Administration recommends they be used for decorative purposes only. The recipients of my cookies are welcome to pick them off, but make no mistake about it, dragees will be present. Available in gold and silver and ranging in size from 2-millimeter pin dots to hefty 7-millimeter orbs, they become the bubbles on my champagne glasses, the ornaments on my Christmas trees, the eyes on my black cats. Cookie mania can easily be an all-night undertaking, often until 4 or 5 a.m. Maybe it would take less time if I didn't have the companion compulsion to watch HGTV while I work. The mindless parade of divine design, color correction, and house hunters comforts me as I mix up a new batch of green icing. The stripes that run together on my T-shirt cookies aren't nearly as hard to repair as Chris's tired siding. We're going to do this with a whimsical ceiling graphic, Candace Olson says on Divine Design, and I add stripes to my green fish. We're all creating together. On his way to bed, my husband wanders through the kitchen with a hopeful look on his face. "So how's it going?" he asks. "Any disasters?" He's not really curious about my success. He's just trolling for the discards. I'm not creating masterpieces. I've never learned to pipe frosting from a pastry bag, and I can barely draw a straight line with a ruler. I rely mostly on cookie shapes that communicate an idea quickly and clearly, without the need for me to draw anything with icing. Decoration is simple. Squiggles of frosting can become wool on a sheep or hair on an angel. Dragees can form the clapper on a bell or the face of a snowman. All it takes is imagination and time. Our next article is about Nicole Kidman, A New Nicole by Joanna Schillner. Take a quick tour of downtown Nashville, and there's no sign that Nicole Kidman lives here. No swarms of paparazzi, no posters of her upcoming films. The face of her husband, country music megastar Keith Urban, is all over on the radio station billboards, on collages of country crooners painted on the side of buildings. A sign in front of the American Red Cross office reads, "Donate blood, win Keith Urban tickets." But Kidman is practically invisible and happy about it. "I love living here," Kidman says, kicking off her sandals and settling into an armchair in a local hotel. She's dressed in a floaty white skirt and a cotton camisole. "It's a long way from New York and Los Angeles, but that's part of the attraction. I feel protected here, especially now that I have the baby." The baby is one-year-old Sunday Rose, to whom she gave birth to at age 41. "There are certain limitations to my career because I'm based here, and that's cool. Keith has enormous ambitions, which I support. His tours and albums are much bigger than what I'm doing right now." Don't be misled. Kidman is doing plenty. She spends a lot of time on the couple's 36-acre farm, about 45 minutes outside of Nashville. "If I was unhappy, I wouldn't be able to live on a farm. I'd feel too lonely," she says. "But when you're happy, I think you can live anywhere." She loves their thickets of trees, her vegetable garden. "Most mornings, Urban plays the piano for her, and Sunday, I hum a little," she says. "When your husband's a huge singer, that's the last thing you do, is sing with him." Every week, she hosts a 10 a.m. baby group, moms and dads eating muffins and sharing intel. "This is my way of having 10 kids," said Kidman, who confides that she would like to have another. Her two older children, Isabella, 16, and Connor, 14, live mostly with their father, Tom Cruise, in Los Angeles. Because Kidman and Urban have a rule, they don't spend more than 4 days apart, she often accompanies him to gigs. They also have a place in Los Angeles with rooms for Isabella and Connor, and they own a 110-acre cattle ranch in Australia that has 4 alpacas. Sunday's third word was wow, and I say that word a lot, said Kidman. "I hope when I'm 80, I will still be saying it. I've been given extraordinary opportunities with huge dreams fulfilled. I'm 42, and my eyes are still wide open." Between 2001 and 2008, Kidman made 17 movies, of which The Hours won her a Best Actress Oscar. But it seems Kidman's days of zooming from one film set to the next are over. "I was running from my life, in a way," she says. "My imaginary life was better than my flesh and blood life. That's a sad thing to say, but it was. Now I love my real life so much, it requires enormous belief in a film to want to take it on." She pauses, then says, "I think that we're in a world to connect, because that's what you're left with. You're not left with your house or your awards or your money. You're left with the people that you build relationships with." She was lured away to a role in the new musical Nine. The movie stars Daniel Day-Lewis as director, enthralled with the women in his life, his mother, Sophia Loren, his wife, Marion Cotillard, his mistress, Penelope Cruz, his costume designer, Judy Dench, his prostitute, Stacey Fergie Ferguson, a reporter who's profiling him, Kate Hudson, and his lead actress and muse, Kidman. On the set in Italy, the makeshift green room filled with couches and draperies become a kind of cave where the actresses gather to compare blisters from their respective dance numbers and to talk about life. Sunday was only 6 weeks old, and when she wasn't nursing or attached to Kidman in a sling, the other women took turns caring for her. "Kate had her son there," Kidman recalls, "and Penelope and Fergie were like, 'I can't wait to have a baby. We're all women's women.'" Kidman brings energy to her marriage, which was tested early on when Urban entered rehab for alcohol addiction shortly after the wedding. "Keith and I have a very honest, profound marriage, which we both contribute to every day," she says. "We have a phrase, 'Does this contribute to the good of our union?' Because that's what's most important," she smiles. "I love being in love. I believe in the power of love, the way it can heal. The more you keep choosing it, because there are times when you can choose to be angry at the person or to love him, the more it nourishes a family." As if on cue, there's a knock at the door. "Here he is," Kidman thrills. Urban, shaggily handsome, has come to pick her up. A hotel guard escorts her and Urban down in the elevator, waving away people who tried to board on other floors. The lobby is jumping with teenagers on a church retreat. As Kidman and Urban pass through, the kids fall silent. But the second the doors close, they erupt, craning their necks to see them go. The famous singer and the very happy mom. In the health news, a better breast cancer drug? Certain therapeutic drugs used to treat breast cancer can affect your memory and attention span, but some types may do less damage than others. In a recent Swiss study, women who have received Femara for 5 years scored better on tests of memory and brain function than those who had taken tamoxifen. Both medicines have been shown to be effective at reducing the risk of breast cancer again. You may be a candidate for Femaral if you're past menopause. It doesn't work for in premenopausal women. Ask your oncologist about its pros and cons compared to tamoxifen. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the Ladies Home Journal December-January combination issue. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Ready Reading Service. So long until next time.